Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History. My name is Yana Byers, and I'm here today with Professor Carol Dyhouse, Professor Emerita of History at the University of Sussex. She's the author of numerous articles relating to women and higher education, as well as the monographs Girl Trouble, Panic and Progress in the History of Young Women, 2013, Zed Books, and Glamour, Women, History, and Feminism, also from Zed Books in 2010, and then two earlier publications from Routledge, Students, A Gendered History, and No Distinction of Sex, Women in British Universities, 1870 to 1939. Hello, Carol.
Hello, Yana.
So, how are you today? Are you in Sussex?
I am in a very cold Sussex, but it's sunny, so I'm not complaining.
Excellent. Wonderful. All right. So, I see a pretty clear and steady progression from the 1995 No Distinction of Sex straight through to Heartthrobs, but that might not be clear to everyone in our audience. So would you like to comment on how your latest work follows the trajectory of your earlier work?
Yes. Well, I'm a feminist historian, fairly obviously, and I spent most of my life in universities writing academic and hopefully scholarly books. And those books may, in the main, have focused on a history of women in education and women in universities, those kinds of subjects, although I'm broadly interested in most aspects of modern British women's history. But about 10 years ago, I thought, I'd quite like to try and write books that appeal to a bigger audience that weren't just intended for scholarly readers and that would, you know, chance their arm a bit more and look at subjects which, well, perhaps a bit untried. So the book on Glamour is subtitled Women and Feminism, Women History Feminism. But it's an attempt to do something quite different and to look at, well, whether glamour is oppressive to women, whether it's always been oppressive to women. It was also an attempt, an opportunity to do fun stuff like look at vintage clothes stores and go around perfume museums and look at textile and clothing museums, yeah, and the history of makeup and stuff like that. So all that kind of material culture of femininity, which I wanted to look at as a feminist and wasn't prepared, I think, to see as just oppressive, as just putting women down and turning them into objects. So Glamour was a new venture. And I really enjoyed writing it, and I found it very intellectually stimulating to think about the ways in which glamour had been sometimes enabling for women. If you look at, you know, the film stars of the 1930s, they're very powerful women. They're not exactly oppressed or totally subjects of the objects of the male gaze, you know. So I wanted to do something different, and then that led on to the book on Girl Trouble, which was an attempt to do a very broad focus book looking at whether women had benefited or been reduced by modern history. And it sort of had to take on a lot of moral panics around girlhood, you know, from the alleged white slave traffic of the 1900s of the suffrage period, right the way through to Ladettes and you know, female chauvinist pigs and so on, allegedly, in the 1990s. So I wanted to do a something again that would be very broad. I mean, in universities, you tend to focus on smaller scholarly things, and I just wanted to be a bit more swashbuckling. And if I want, if I should say why, heartthrobs was. I mean, that was interesting. When I gave book talks on glamour, a lot of gay men said, "Why aren't you looking at male glamour?" And you know, I thought you're right. I mean, I touch in glamour on the glamour of, say, RAF pilots in those gorgeous pale blue uniforms, you know, with silver wings on their kind of glamour associated with airline pilots in the earlier part of the century. But I didn't fully look at male glamour. And I was thinking a bit about that. And then I was thinking, I mean, the real takeoff point for the book on heartthrobs was John Berger's ways of seeing, you know, John Berger, the art critic, who did a very well received TV series, but he also did a book called Ways of Seeing, which was published, I think, about 1972. And he said things which became central to the sort of feminist way of thinking about things and feminist canon, if you like, almost. He said that men look at women and women see themselves through the eyes of men. And that idea that women have traditionally been the objects of the male gaze and can only see themselves as objectified through the eyes of men bothered me. It has its virtues. It's a really helpful way of looking at things, but it's not the whole story. And I thought, what if we reverse that and look at how women look at men? Because you don't actually have to spend very long in the company of other women, do you, to know that they talk about men quite effusively? And so I thought, well, what happens is often, in many ways. And I thought, well, what happens if you look historically at that? You look at how women have been able to talk about men, in what kinds of areas they've talked about men, and how, and that sort of gets you thinking about the nature of female desire and whether that is culturally constructed or something innate, you know. And that's what Heartthrobs is really about. It's an attempt to look at changing fashions in men, the way desirable masculinity has changed since, say, the late 18th century. That makes sense.
There is something that is some kind of inadvertently feminist, just simply subjecting, or perhaps directly pointedly feminist, in subjecting know, men to the female gaze and looking at how that's been done. It's really delightful. It's a great idea. And it's so much fun. So such a fun book. So one of the things that really, really struck me with looking at it was how much fun it must have been to do the research for this. Although I'm thinking maybe purses and bags might have been even cooler, but would you like to talk to me?
I mean, it wasn't just an opportunity to look at sort of sexy men, you know, although that was one of the sort of fringe benefits, wasn't it? To go and look at men on
it certainly didn't hurt, did it?
No, the research was enormously fun because in looking at men themselves, I mean, I look at popular fiction a lot, and I look at film, obviously, massively, particularly the early years of cinema when Rudolph Valentino really established himself as the first sort of massive heartthrob on screen. I mean, before that, you have heartthrobs like Byron or List, you know, who allegedly had women swooning. Well, List had women collecting his cigar stubs and sticking them down their fronts, didn't he, and swooning because they... I mean, he's often thought of as one of the first kind of major heartthrobs in history. Byron had women, you know, besotted and ostensibly well-behaved middle-class women writing to him, you know, offering to meet him under the bushes in Hyde Park and stuff like that. I mean, it was, again, a phenomenon. But with Rudolph Valentino, you get the first massive screen heartthrob. And it's so interesting because men hated him. You know, he was denounced roundly in America for being puffy and not being white and waspish and so on. And I think men were very shocked by the fact that women, you know, went crazy about him. And what intrigued me about that is, in a sense,
he's also like there's an ethnicity issue there as well, right? He's not proper.
Absolutely. He's not proper at all. He's a ladies' man. And that phrase in itself is fascinating, isn't it? Because ladies' man usually means, not masculine enough, not a proper red blood male. But of course, you know, that raises questions about whether women always wanted red blooded males in the way that men thought they did. And when I think back about Rudolf Valentino, I mean, he did, in a sense, reshape ideals of masculinity, because although he caused all this trouble, I mean, because he was so successful with women, he sort of makes men rethink fashions, and you find the fashion for sort of, you know, slicked back hair becomes fairly universal. And you know, there's a brand of condoms which you can still find advertised on the web called Shake Condoms, you know, which kind of capital. I mean, at the time they were manufactured, you can still find old ones if you Google them.
That's amazing.
In which they were packaged anyway. I'm not sure about the genuine articles. But what I mean was that the condoms were advertised as being shape condoms, because in a sense, Rudolf Valentino had redefined masculinity and the shake with all the associations of that came from, you know, the very powerful way he enacted that in the film The Shake, you know, which was based on E.M. Hall's novel, but was a fantastic success. Sort of reshapes masculinity. It challenges people to rethink what desirable masculinity is. So that way, women affect ideals of masculinity through their consumerism, you know.
Sure, that's interesting. Yeah, I'm sure there's an article to be written about the Shake versus the Trojan condom. I'm convinced that would make it someone else's job.
Exactly.
Oh, that's really fun. Well, you watched a lot of films and read a lot of books too, right?
Yes.
The kind of books you're supposed to feel guilty about reading too.
Well, that was it. I mean, when I was at school, I didn't get to read stuff that the teachers disapproved of, like, you know, Catherine Windsor's Forever Amber. I mean, other people read those. You know, I was supposed to be a sort of scholarly girl and didn't, you know, to do that, but in my dotage, as it were, I was able to read all this stuff I missed out on as a young girl because I was so serious minded, and to treat it academically, because it is fun, and I really delved down into this, what you might call the pond life of popular literature. Because what's interesting, if you're a social and cultural historian, is the impact that these texts had. For instance, when I started writing Heartthrobs, somebody said to me, or a friend of mine who's a writer called Imogen Robertson, she said, you'll obviously look at Charles Garvis. And I said, who? She said, Garvis, have you not seen his book? And embarrassed after, you know, 30 years of teaching social history and kind of popular literature and stuff. I thought, no, I haven't. So I started to look up Charles Garvis, and he was massively, massively, massively popular. I mean, he made a fortune out of his popular writing, which was either under his own name or under a sort of female pseudonym. But they were romances, and they have masses to say about what women want in men. And the fact that they sold so prolifically means that he hit a nerve. So I was able to kind of read all this kind of thing. And then it gets you to rethink.
I've never heard of this man. Now I have an assignment for later. Brilliant.
Charles Garvis.
Oh, that's brilliant.
G-A-R-V-I-C.
Oh, right. Oh, brilliant.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Okay, so what would you tell me is your overall argument? What if I have one take up, what is it?
Okay. What I think was my central sort of theme is that, and it was something I discovered in the course of doing the book, is that fashions in masculinity have to do with women's social position at any particular time. You see, if you look on the surface of it, when I started, I thought, so what kinds of blokes appear massively in the literature, say, at the end of the 19th century? And hardly surprisingly, they're sort of imperial adventurers and, you know, kind of soldiers and things like that. And you can understand all that. And then as we mentioned earlier, you know, the RAF pilot comes in the 20s and 30s and so on as a big thing. And then doctors in the 1950s, you know, the popularity of hospital romances, you know, doctor meets nurse and nurse. It's just huge. I mean, Mills and Boon couldn't find enough authors to write hospital romances in the 50s. So at some level, you think, oh, yeah, well, you know, what it is about sexy men is that they reflect the fashions of the time. And then you think, well, it's not all that, is it? You know, there's something more going on. And I think I decided in the course of writing that if the more that is going on is what's happening to women at any particular time. So that, for instance, the fashion for Arab sheikhs, you know, which comes around the Valentino period and stays. If you look at girls' magazines through the 30s, there's just no shortage of, you know, white Rajah stories or, you know, desert princes who carry women off to their tents, as Rudolph Valentino did in The Sheikh. You know, I mean, it sticks and sticks at a fantasy level. So I think what I found more interesting is how you can answer the question of how changes in women's social position lead to fashions for different kinds of men. That's the main argument of the book, I think.
Yeah, that's sounds good. I like it. So you touched on several.
Sorry, do you want me to say a bit more about that? A bit more about that is that as women become consumers, they can express their desires. So it's the fact that they consume cheap romantic fiction, you know, from the Mills and Boon period on, really, or the circulating libraries on, up until the present day, although a lot of it's web-based now. But, you know, it's the fact that they become consumers. I mean, it's the women who go to cinemas. Some women went allegedly two or three times a week when cinema was at its height of fashion. And it's because women's behaviour changes as consumers that certain kinds of masculinity become fashionable because they can express it. And then I think the way you understand doctors in the 50s is that it's a little bit of a kind of backwards trend, because after the Second World War, there was a sort of back to the home, glorifying domesticity sort of movement. And if you think about, you know, you think about young women, if you're going to choose a bloke to marry, and, you know, what do you go for? You want to go for somebody with prospects. You want to go for somebody maybe who's stable, who's professionally got good status, who's going to be a stable, reassuring sort of presence through a long life. And who better than to marry a young doctor?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, respectable, smart.
Yeah, and it was a good bet to marry a doctor. And that's why I think you get all those doctor romances and the doctor movies at that time, you know. So I think behind every fashion in masculinity, there's something altering in women's social position. And it was that relationship which I think becomes the main theme of the book, really.
Right. Sure. And as women are able to express that as consumers, and there's a response there. Oh, fantastic. So there's a few The book is organized according to some of the archetypes, really, I think we can call them, right? And I was wondering if you would like to talk about a few of those. Particularly, I love the chapter Once Upon a Dream.
Oh, that's about the Prince Charming, isn't it? Is it?
Yeah, I love that. And it takes me back to that countless hours I spent with Disney movies and like fairy tales.
Yeah.
Oh, I was a sucker for that.
Once Upon a Dream, yes. Well, that's that obviously immediately makes you think of Disney. And the thing about that chapter, I kind of forget what I put in it now. But I got very much the sort of Prince Charming archetype, you know, which is obviously in Cinderella, but gets extended very much with, I think if you look at the pictures in the book, there's a wonderful one of Rudolph Valentino's Monsieur Beaucaire having a sort of wet shirt moment almost, you know, instead of his gold braid and his ruffles, you know, you suddenly see him with a naked torso and yet he's still got his powdered wig on, you know. Actually, that's for me.
Didn't want to be caught without that.
The construction of the Prince Charming. And, you know, there are romantic novelists from Barbara Cartland to Georgette Heyer, who I think is brilliant, by the way. I mean, that was Georgette Heyer was somebody else I never read at school because she was frowned upon by, you know, our very scholarly teachers. We were two very academic schools. And you just didn't read this stuff. But boy, do I read it these days. because it helped so much. And actually, Georgette Heyer is extremely witty and a very good read. She's not the bottom of the pond when we look at pond life literature. But I do look at pond life literature. What I was going to say was just that... I've almost forgotten. Hang on, it'll come back. Oh, yes, the contempt with which the literary establishment has often loaded its remarks against women. I mean, if you look at Q.D. Leavis, who was married to F.R. Leavis, you know, and was a critic, obviously, she sneers at what she calls typists' romances or, you know, mill girls' romances. And those kinds of denunciations, which are everywhere if you look at the history of 20th century literature, they carry a sort of double burden of contempt, don't they? I mean, it's contempt for what women like to read on one hand, but it's also contempt for working class women. It's a kind of class snobbery because when you talk about a mill girl or a typist or a, you know, or a servant girl, you're kind of putting them down for their class as well as their gender. And I think, you know, that we can learn a great deal as social historians from examining the fantasies of young working class women.
Oh, God, yeah, certainly. I mean, what's important and the idea as well, just the reminder that the dream is to be kind of carried away. Right? You have this life that's not too pleasant and then you've been carried off and by your prince, you know, this perfect Prince Charming.
Yes, we probably don't have so many princes these days.
You know, okay, though, do you know, I don't know how much this plays, but there's a channel in the US called the Hallmark Channel.
Uh-huh.
And it is just lady television and it's mocked relentlessly. But starting sometime in mid-November, they start playing these Christmas movies. Mm-hmm. And they're the exact same thing. And you're kind of like admitting that you like them. It's you admit to a guilty pleasure. But I just this morning as I was leaving my house, I saw an ad for the third Christmas Prince movies. Like there was the Christmas Prince and then the Royal Wedding. And now she's having a baby. And it's some like American, not too interesting human who goes to a fictional kingdom, meets a prince and they fall in love.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
he's dashing. I mean, this is still, there's a lot of power to that still.
Well, that's because so many women are fairly powerless, I think. I mean, I don't think that's the entire story, but I think one of the ways we can understand the pull of this is that if you've got a kind of fairly boring, mundane, or even poverty-struck and grim existence, then, you know, dreams of transformation are what keep you going, aren't they? You, again and again, it's kind of scattered literature and it's hard to kind of pull together. But I tried. Obviously, after you've written the book, other stuff comes up. And I came across just one of those sort of slim autobiographical, you know, myself when young texts not so long ago, written by a woman called Joyce Story, who lived in Bristol. And she has a passage about how miserable she was in elementary school in the 1930s. And she said she used to sit in the playground and just fantasize that Rudolph Valentino or somebody like him was coming on a big white horse and he would carry her off, you know, and make her life wonderful. And this notion that you could be transported and your life can be transformed is a very powerful fantasy and a form of consolation for people who are finding life hard work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. I mean, I think that it's getting, the hold is getting less, isn't it? Because, you know, if you compare the early Disney movies to the later ones, if you compare Sleeping Beauty, Snow White and Cinderella, for instance, with, say, Moana and Frozen 1, you can see that things have changed quite massively. I mean, they're awfully wet, those early Disney heroines. Get carried off by princes, they really are hopeless, aren't they?
No personality, they're these little dresses.
Yeah, well, that's right. Princes don't have much personality either, do they? I mean, in a sense, they're ciphers, because all you need to do is gesture in the direction of, you know, servant girl is transformed by fairy godmother and prince carries her away. And we all know, I mean, you know, how you probably could express the whole fantasy in about, you know, six words.
Sure. Absolutely.
familiar. But I'm not sure it's got so much hold today, you know, because princesses have got rather more about them now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Imagine Meghan having that. Well, maybe she did have that fantasy. Who knows? You know, she's too, you know, they have too much personality these days. And I think that's a good thing. Yeah. It doesn't stop the fantasies, but it does mean... It does mean you probably check your own fantasies a bit, don't you?
Yeah, I suppose. And there, I mean, just it is true that women have considerably more opportunities than ever. So, you know, there's kind of, I teach, as you know, I'm teaching 20-year-olds, and they talk about being their own prince, like making their
good
own
for them.
Yeah,
good
absolutely.
For them.
Absolutely. Okay.
So, it doesn't seem fantasy, though. We'd all like life to be perfect. We'd all like, you know, I mean, the thing is that you could be, you know, if somebody carries you off and puts you in their castle, I mean, you'd get pretty bored soon, wouldn't you?
Definitely. Absolutely. I'm like, there's probably not even theater. That sounds like no fun.
No, and I really, really love clothes, but I mean, there's only, you can't spend your entire life
just changing from dress to dress. No.
Just getting dressed up, you know. It would get terribly boring.
Terribly bored. Okay. So I would like to ask, and my final important, super important question, who's your favorite of the heartthrobs?
Ah! People always ask that. I probably answer differently each time. When I was growing up, I had a thing about Rudolf Nureyev. I think it was just that masculine grace. I mean, when you see him in corsair pirouetting across the stage, but that's interesting too, isn't it? That's interesting too, because women do like male dancers, and that's a challenge to a lot of conventional ideas of masculinity. There's something about, you know, grace and expression that hasn't always sat easily with masculinity, but it's something women often go for.
That's all right. That's fascinating. What fun. Oh, wonderful. I love this book. I had so much fun reading it. These interviews are funny. It's a joy. I get to read all kinds of different fun stuff. And so I cannot recommend it enough. Did you have fun writing it?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
So what's next?
Ah, well, I think I might sort of develop this a bit further to actually look at the transition from Cinderella to Frozen, looking at the different patternings of love lives, not so much, you know, men that one fantasizes about, but that women have fantasized about historically, but the shifts in sort of what has been desired in terms of relationships with men and family structures and so on. A sort of broad social history of women from 1950 to up to 2013, because I think Frozen 1 will be my cutoff point. I have seen Frozen 2, but but I think it was Frozen 1 that is the turning point.
I think that sounds right. I mean, like, obviously you're the expert on this one. But I think, I mean, that just sits properly. And what a fun thing to think about too. Like, the Cinderella is boring. She's so good. Anyway, but I mean,
American versions are a bit different from British versions, actually. You know, that's
what, yeah, that is also true. Yeah. And the older folk tales are a whole nother matter, but that's fascinating. Well, that's great. So thank you very much. I've taken up quite enough of your time. So, we'll just close. Is there anything else that I desperately need to know?
No, thank you for talking to me, Jana. I enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you so much, Carol. It was great.